better and how to hold themselves. And then they would be prepared, I think, much better for after, because I think a lot of us wait till we've stood wrong and we've fallen over and we had C-sections or whatever, and everything's, by then you're really a mess. I think if we taught people before how to stand and how to be.
Well, they do that for total joints. They have joint camps, so we should have pregnancy camps. How nice would that be?
Yeah.
Oh my God. Well, I hope we helped you.
Yes, you did. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for calling.
Of course. Have a good night.
Thanks. So I think we're coming down to the end of our hour of here at Doctors Making a House Call on WNUC.
It seems like we just started.
See? So glad we had the time together.
I am too.
So again, the last hour has been with myself, Dr. Sharfus, and Dr. Steve Arbit. And he, again, is a physical medicine and rehab specialist. If you are interested in finding him or one of his partners for pain, joint issues, the number is 248-650-5861. Of course, I'm your gynecologist obstetrician that comes to you every other week or the second and fourth Mondays. And if you want more information and want to have an appointment with me or one of my partners, our number is 248-489-1070. You can always find me too on Facebook at Dr. Debbie's Wellness. Again, reviewing, we talked a little bit about how it's important to take care of your back, your joints, and things that are the simple, well, I guess not really simple, but important to start with, is that we should always watch out and try to keep ourselves lower weight, be healthy, keep yourself busy, walking, staying fit, and hopefully you won't have to get a knee or hip replacement later. Thanks everyone for listening, and we'll see you again on the second Monday of March. Thank you. Good night.
WNUC, LP 96.7 FM, Detroit.
This is Peace Talks Radio, the series on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution. I'm series producer Paul Ingalls. Today, what you might call an independent spinoff from Ken Burns' 2014 PBS documentary on the Roosevelts. Later, we're going to explore just a bit about the history of Franklin Delano Roosevelt and Eleanor Roosevelt from a peace studies standpoint. By the way, we'll have much, much more online at peacetalksradio.com. But first, we spotlight a chapter in the Teddy Roosevelt story. In that section of the Burns epic, there was quite a bit about TR's lust for battle, but only a couple of minutes about his role as a behind-the-scenes broker that helped shape the terms of a peace agreement between Japan and Russia, ending a brutal Asian war at the start of the 20th century. We're going to expand for more than 2 minutes on the Roosevelt effort that won him the Nobel Peace Prize in 1906, only the sixth person to be awarded the prize then, and the first American to win it. In 1905, the world was watching the second year of the Russo-Japanese War with keen interest. As United States president then, Roosevelt wanted the U.S. to start taking a bigger role in steering international affairs, so he brought the principal negotiators from Russia and Japan to the U.S. Roosevelt met only briefly with them on a yacht in Oyster Bay off Long Island before sending them off to the naval yard town of Portsmouth, New Hampshire to negotiate on their own. Roosevelt was never there at Portsmouth for the treaty talks, but still, in 30 days after a few breakdowns, a war-ending deal was struck. Again, online, peacetalksradio.com, you can hear much, much more about the particulars of that time and that war from our first guest. But here now, this part of our conversation with Charles Doliak, on a Skype call from New Hampshire. Mr. Doliak is a Portsmouth lawyer and one of the most knowledgeable people around about this event. Here he talks with me on the role the town of Portsmouth, New Hampshire itself played in helping to urge the parties to peace.
Essentially what Roosevelt did is he said, I'll let you two negotiate directly. You'll negotiate at the shipyard, which is a Portsmouth Naval facility, so the Navy was actually in charge of the protocol for the formal negotiations. And the governor of the state of New Hampshire was the host of the parties socially, et cetera, and was using the townspeople and churches and, frankly, all kinds of social groups to entertain the negotiators in between. Now, it was kind of like the Olympics, if you think about it. You can imagine if all of a sudden the Olympics are going to happen in your town, would you want to be someone who is creating an atmosphere where they would be successful and that everybody would push for the idea, stay at the table long enough to create a peace. And that's what happened in Portsmouth. People that were formally involved in the social events, people that were at churches, people took them to baseball games, people would meet them on the street, especially the Russians, because there was a Jewish population here that spoke Russian, obviously, and had come from the Pale and spoke with the Russians, et cetera, and did. In fact, there were petitions from the Jewish population that hopefully peace would be achieved in an honorable way, but that the fighting would stop. And so this constant social milieu where people were encouraging the delegates clearly had an effect, especially in terms of neither side wanting to be the one to leave the table first.
Am I hearing you correctly that Roosevelt was aware that this would have an impact and was encouraging it, or did some of it just seem to come from the pride of Portsmouth?
I think both. Mm-hmm. Roosevelt went to Harvard, and he was an aristocrat, so to speak. And there were a number of people here in this area that summered from Harvard, and some of those were people he knew. But the local people really jumped into it, and the Russians and the Japanese both commented on it, especially after the treaty was negotiated successfully. They could not get over the sense that the population had been so good to them, their hospitality was so great. One example of that is that the hotel they stayed in, the Wentworth by the Sea Hotel, was offered to them at no price by the proprietors of it at the time. Wentworth by the Sea is there today. It's a great part of their history. So, there are many, many stories about this. And what's interesting about it is just like the Olympics. If you talk to anybody that's been in an Olympic town, you understand what that one person can really affect international goodwill just by being hospitable and interested in the peace being successful. So this idea that every person counts, everybody can make a difference in international affairs, is what's going on in Portsmouth. And it's going on now. I mean, when you invite anybody to your house some kind of visit from a foreign country, a student exchange, all this stuff adds up. That's what's now known multi-track diplomacy. Multi-track diplomacy means in a treaty itself, but the concept of community diplomacy, public diplomacy, citizen diplomacy, everybody can make a difference. And it played out in the peace treaty.
Well, it helps to have the peace table right down the street from you, but I suppose that what you're describing is something of a metaphor that if we could imagine the peace table is right down the street from us and act accordingly, then we might have different results.
And what's interesting about it, you just think about it. If all of a sudden in your town, somebody came to you and said, there's going to be a negotiation between the Palestinians and the Israelis, and there's people are going to come here, what would you do? And, I think if you had a shot, you'd want to be someone that was trying to be hospitable and creating an atmosphere where the negotiations would be friendly. And in negotiation theory now, as I understand it, those that are in the scholarship of it, they think about that stuff. They think about setting that kind of stuff up for the negotiators. And they think about things about having the negotiators playing with children, inviting them to go to a school and talk to children, both sides of the negotiation. It humanizes the process. It humanizes what war is and means. And people's interplay in that regard can be and critical. And so most diplomatic scholars will talk about that. But back then, nobody talked about it. They kind of just did it. And it wasn't really well known until 2005 what effect this had. Because when you looked at the negotiations, you could see there was a breakdown, and for 10 days there was a deadlock. And when you look at what happened with the negotiators' time during that deadlock, you'll find that it was totally occupied by all kinds of social events created by the local populace and the state politicians to encourage them to stay and encourage them to think that even though it was deadlocked, there might be a way out. And the other thing is, Roosevelt did three things. First of all, he got the parties to come here. That's a big deal, just getting him to the table. Second thing he did is he said, if you're going to negotiate and you reach an issue that you do not agree to, I encourage you to just skip over it and go to the next issue. And that's the way they negotiated. And what happened was they had a number of issues that they had to decide in terms of control of Korea and Manchuria. And they agreed on all those issues, which are like, you know, 9 or 10 of the 12 issues involved. So by the time they went back to the two that they had not agreed on, they had an awful lot of good stuff on the table that they really didn't want to leave and go back to war over. So he created that methodology. And third, he critically was involved in back-channel diplomacy with both the Russians and the Japanese. He had a direct line with the Japanese, and he had sent, realizing what the Russians were and how they operated, he had his best friend, a guy from Harvard who was a diplomat, one of the best diplomats the United States had, sent to Moscow, to St. Petersburg, to be the one that talked to the Tsar. And he went and talked to the Tsar at a critical stage and got the Tsar to agree to give up some territory that he probably would not have agreed to, which was a critical part of the compromise. And he deserved the Nobel Peace Prize for what he did. He really did. But surrounding all of this, keeping them at the table, was this local groups that were trying to foster a good atmosphere for peace.
We're talking on the Skype line from New Hampshire with Charles Doliak of the PortsmouthPeaceTreaty.com. Charles, I think those interested in the history of peacemaking struggle with Roosevelt as a figure a little bit. The Ken Burns documentary scholars seem to agree on his kind of visceral love of war, yet you have this Nobel Peace Prize for the Portsmouth Treaty in the mix, along with his advocacy for more social equality, his challenges of big business, his affection for conservation. So many contradictions in this story. Where do you find yourself landing in your opinion of him these many years later?
Yeah. Well, I think that you said it pretty well, that he is a multifaceted guy. He was a trust buster. He was against the big trusts. He was wealthy himself, but he was not a robber baron, and he didn't like them very much. He's a conservationist, et cetera. He was a very smart, intellectual guy. He read all the time, and Kurt Burns did a very nice job explaining that. But he clearly believed in the United States becoming, and he foresaw this, the indispensable national power that would, international power, but in its own national interest, that would be the tipping point for keeping a balance of power of peace in the world. And it's a great statement everybody always uses about him, which is that he walk softly and carry a big stick.
I think it's speak softly.
I'm sorry. Speak softly, carry a big stick. Who do you know does that? Think about it. And I think if you think about some fairly major religious figures, the stick doesn't look like something that's necessarily something they're going to beat you with, but it's a big mitre, so to speak. That phrase is not a warlike phrase. That phrase, properly understood, if it comes from Africa, is a peaceful phrase. And it means that you're not going to use the stick, and you don't want to use the stick, and you don't want to threaten anybody. But on the other hand, another one of Roosevelt's famous Aesop's fables was, if you're going to try to create peace, you have to have the power to prevent the aggressor from upsetting it. So you don't cut a deal. If the wolves are negotiating with the lambs, the first thing the lambs should not do, which is what they did in Aesop's fables, is trade away their guard dogs as a gesture of peace, because then the warlike wolves could take advantage of them. You have to have a power, but use it for peace, for a balance of power, not for aggression and negative international events. And I don't think they gave him credit for that. And if Roosevelt had been around during World War I, although he desperately wanted to get into it, my guess is Roosevelt would have been much more aggressive about using American, trying to use American power prevent the war from getting out of control and to get people to the table to see if they would negotiate before the war got as deep as it did. He definitely thought the United States was going to be the ultimate balancing power after England. That's what he really thought. And he said sitting in the United States was kind of in a way easier. And I think he meant it for all the right reasons, but you know, he made mistakes. He would be politically incorrect on some issues now, but in terms of understanding spheres of influence, balance of power, trying to create a mix that works, that creates peace, there's no question that he saw it, he understood it, and he was very, very successful in doing it in this war, because this war ended the war between Japan and Russia. They were the two primary powers, the expansive powers in Asia. And he looked at them as kind of like blocking each other out. And just to, you know, just to make sure everybody understood the game, Roosevelt then sent the Great White Fleet, colored white for peace, by the way, to Asia. So everybody saw that we were kind of in the game too. But he did create that balance, and the Russians and the Japanese didn't go to war again in World War One. Didn't go to war again until the end of World War Two, although they had some skirmishes with some overzealous Japanese generals in the 30s. Generally speaking, the peace held for a long time.
On our website, you'll be able to hear much more from Charles Doliak of PortsmouthPeaceTreaty.com about the details of Teddy Roosevelt's brokering of that peace agreement between the warring nations of Japan and Russia in the early years of the 20th century. Check it out at peacetalksradio.com. I'm series producer Paul Ingalls, and today we're spinning off from the popular 2014 Ken Burns PBS documentary on the Roosevelts. Next, we talk with one of the experts that the Burns documentary included, Dr. Alida Black from the George Washington University in Washington, D.C. Dr. Black has written extensively about Eleanor Roosevelt. Her 2014 release is Eleanor Roosevelt's last book, Tomorrow is Now, with an extensive introduction from Dr. Alida Black. And she's also extremely familiar with Franklin Delano Roosevelt's story, of course, too. Dr. Alida Black, welcome to Peace Talks Radio.
I'm thrilled to be here. Thanks for having me.
FDR's social record and many of his famous speeches come off as benchmarks of compassion. And yet, FDR is often thought of as a war president as he steered the country through World War II, and he was certainly secretly ushering in the nuclear age with the Manhattan Project, all at the same time that he was setting the groundwork for the United Nations in 1942. Would you agree that FDR is a bit of a riddle to peace studies scholars?
Well, only if they really look at FDR in a one-dimensional sort of cartoon book way. FDR never really wanted to go into war, but he tried everything he could to delay the war. But once he came to the conviction that war was inevitable, he did everything he could to minimize America's involvement in the war and to make it very clear, both to the American people and to the world, why we were fighting the war in values terms. And so I think it's really impossible to talk about FDR and war without talking about FDR and the Four Freedoms and FDR's profound commitment to the birth of the United Nations.
Well, the Miller Center at the University of Virginia writes about FDR. FDR hoped that the war, once in it, would produce a more secure and peaceful post-war world. Is that a fair assessment?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, FDR famously said, more than an end to war, we need an end to the beginning of wars. And one key facet of this to FDR was the dismantling of empire. And so if you look at FDR and Churchill when they met in that summer of 1941 in the middle of the Atlantic, FDR is conditioning really American aid to Britain on the dismantling of empire, which he really believed was one of the primary causes of war.
anybody who is watching this fictionalized series called Manhattan will hear the scientists many, many times talk about how the development of the bomb is going to ensure peace. Let me have you talk a little bit about that possible philosophy that the government, Roosevelt, scientists were pursuing when they were pursuing this terrible destructive bomb.
Well, I think they very much believed that. I don't think this is a romanticized view at all. But the one thing that all of us have to remember is that during the development phase, nobody had a gut-level understanding of the power of this weapon. I mean, not Oppenheimer, not Niels Bohr, not FDR, not any of the military that were in charge of it. They knew that it was going to be an enormously powerful weapon, but nobody envisioned, really, the cataclysmic effect that it had on Nagasaki and Hiroshima. So we have to get this sort of Monday morning historical quarterbacking out of the conversation. It's a what-if question about would FDR have dropped the second bomb after the first one is dropped. It's also a truly hypothetical question of how FDR would have handled those negotiations when, in fact, we knew that the Japanese emperor was willing to surrender. So it's all speculation. I think the one thing that's very clear is that Harry Truman is not FDR and FDR is not Harry Truman. Their whole approaches are different. You know, it's very hard to predict what FDR would have said in that meeting with Groves and the scientists and the War Cabinet about the invasion of Japan. Because we don't know how FDR would have reacted to the increasing slaughter of American troops at the end of the war.
Even before FDR became president, Eleanor Roosevelt was sketching out quite a peacemaking and human rights resume.
Both Roosevelts were committed to the League of Nations and the World Court. Eleanor was profoundly affected by the horrors of war that she saw in 1920 when FDR and Eleanor went over to Europe to investigate the condition of the American fleet when FDR was Assistant Secretary of the Navy. And so to Eleanor, the human consequences of war, the shell-shocked sailors that she tried to work with at St. Elizabeth's, people who were just so traumatized by poison gas and the horror that they saw. She was haunted by that. And so when she comes home after that trip, she redoubles her effort to, in fact, speak out on issues and becomes very involved with Carrie Chapman Catt and the American Committee for the Cause and Cures of War, and also increasingly active to support American veterans.
Well, then FDR ascends to the presidency, and during those first 9 years of FDR's terms, what were Eleanor's leanings and her influence on FDR? And please include or start by telling us something about her 1935 talk known as Because War is Obsolete.
Well, it wasn't really a talk. It was an article that was written for a book that Carrie Chapman Catt asked her to contribute to. It's 1935. It's the huge debate around the World Court and whether America should join the World Court. Both Roosevelts were profoundly committed to that. The Senate disagreed with them. But Eleanor campaigned across the country and even went on a national radio show the night before the Senate vote on the World Court to debate the administration's fierce critics. And so it's sort of in this background that because the idea of war is obsolete was written. She says that, you know, the easy answer to this is that, of course, we cannot do away with war because of human nature. And what Eleanor argues in this piece is not that there will never be war, but that the immediate gut response to go to war to solve a problem is obsolete. In fact, what we need are structures like the League of Nations, the World Court, what will become the United Nations, to in fact have a world forum in which people can be held and nations can be held accountable for their actions, and that the world can help arbitrate their disputes in a way that minimizes conflict. So Eleanor was anti-war, but she was never a pacifist.
Let's talk a little bit about her steps after FDR's death, her work on the Universal Declaration of Human Rights at the United Nations, and other key benchmarks that helped define her totally on her own in the later years of her life.
Well, I think from a peace perspective, the most powerful action, the most long-lasting action that Eleanor took was her role in the early formation of the United Nations. And I would just like your listeners to consider this. Pretend that they are in a room with 18 people, and you're all going to sit around a big square table, and you don't agree on anything except, by God, you beat the Germans. You don't agree on private property or whether private property exists. You don't agree on citizenship, on what the role of government is. You don't agree on God or whether God exists. You don't agree on how an economy is supposed to work. You don't agree on anything except you've won the war. And now you want to extract the spoils of war in a way that will help you rebuild your country. There is not a person on the planet who could have negotiated with or sort of shepherded, if you will, this group of instructed delegates the way that Eleanor Roosevelt did. And it showed a masterful understanding not only of the cultures of the different nations, but how people had to understand and manage fear. And she understood that she would have to convince the United States, who only wanted political and social rights, you know, the right to vote, the right to run for office, the right to organize, the right to pray, the right to speak out, with people who were passionately committed to social and economic rights, the right to work, the right to a salary, the right to a nationality, the right to a religion. How were women and children to be treated in this new world? And so what she was able to finesse in a way that still makes my jaw drop, the United States to, a reluctant United States, I might add, to embrace social and economic rights, and the Eastern Bloc not to object to political and civil rights. And because of that, I really believe the world had a new vision. Because think that you're in this table, and you're seeing for the first time the horrible images, I mean, the unimaginable images that come out not only of the Holocaust camps, but of refugees. There are 40 million starving refugees in Europe. That's almost 7 times the number of people who were killed in the Holocaust camps. Then think about the millions of people that you know who were scarred by this war one way or another. And how do you say to the world, you have a fundamental choice. You can believe that the world is essentially evil and violent and horrible, and that world wars will always occur at 15 and 17 year intervals. Or you can say, yes, there is a horrible element here, but this is a new vision that we must hold on to as a way to counteract that vision. And that's what Eleanor understood, and that's what she gave the world. And it is an extraordinary accomplishment. I mean, for example, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights is now used as a model for more state governments and more constitutions than the U.S. Constitution and the U.S. Bill of Rights. And we now have courts all over the world, including the United States Court, saying that, yes, there is legal merit to this. So it is a stunning accomplishment. And now the terror that we face are from rogue terrorists, not from rogue nations.
You can hear an hour-long version of this show and much more from our interviews with Dr. Alida Black and Charles Doliak by visiting our website, peacetalksradio.com. There, too, you can read transcripts, see photos, sign up for a free podcast and newsletter, order CDs, and help support this series with a tax-deductible contribution to the nonprofit media organization that produces this program separate and apart from your public radio station. Visit us at peacetalksradio.com. Please follow us on Facebook and Twitter, too. Additional support from KUNM at the University of New Mexico. I'm Paul Ingalls. Thanks for listening to and for supporting Peace Talks Radio.
WNUC, LP, 96.7 FM, Detroit. Thank you.